welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 199 of the podcast, and it is 19th of October 2014 as I record this, and my energy is back up, which is very exciting. Generally I just need a lot of sleep, and my husband always laughs at me because I really love sleeping, and I've slept a lot this week and feeling a lot better, back to creative self after the exhaustion of Frankfurt Book Fair. So today I have an interview with Sean Platt, who I'm sure many of you know from the self-publishing podcast, as well as the fantastic book Write, Publish, Repeat, and his great fiction, including Yesterday's Gone with David Wright and The Beam with Johnny B. Truant. But I like to interview the guys on their own, as they actually behave quite differently away from the lads get together. So I think you'll find our chat fascinating as I actually ask Sean things he doesn't usually talk about. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. On industry news, there's been a fantastic story this week about Barbara Freethy, who has sold over 4 million Kindle books and is, I think, the number one Kindle author. And she's just done a deal, a first-in-its-kind deal with Ingram to sell and distribute her books worldwide, basically reaching bookstores as an indie, using her own publishing imprint and the distribution deal through Ingram. And I would think it will pave the way for other popular authors to do something similar. And hopefully over time, that will become more common. There's also been a report that print sales are dominant still, but that a great number of those print sales are through Amazon and online bookstores where people buy print online. I find one of the biggest misconceptions of what we do as indies is people assume, when I speak, people assume that I only publish in ebook format, which is just crazy. I publish in ebook, print and audiobook format. And I recommend everybody do that now. It's at least do ebook and print. It just seems crazy not to. Talking about that, I also wanted to tell you about a great new book, Discoverability by Christine Catherine Rush. So Chris does the Business Rush series of blog posts, and she has put together the most important posts in Discoverability, the book, and there are a lot of really interesting extras, and I just totally recommend that you get this book. It is for fiction authors and is about, well, book marketing, but essentially discoverability. It includes some really interesting stuff around historical reasons around book marketing. So, for example, why book tours were done and why they are pointless, as well as lots of other myth busters. So, as well as what actually works. So I really recommend that you buy that, Discoverability by Christine Catherine Rush, R-U-S-C-H. And my marketing advice, if you have how to market a book, is from the almost newbie perspective. It's the kind of, you know, new in the game, a couple of years in the game, and I don't have any background in traditional publishing, whereas Chris has had over 40 years in the industry and she's worked on every side of publishing, and so she really does know a lot of, you know, what has gone wrong in the past and what is worth doing. So I really recommend that book. What else? Well, I am now 45,000 words into Gates of Hell, which is fun. And I wrote a scene scuba diving in the Dead Sea, which was awesome. I don't even know how I ended up there, really. But I didn't think you could even scuba dive in the Dead Sea. Turns out you can. You just need a hell of a lot of weight. So I'm having a lot of fun with this book. Really happy to be back in the action adventure phase of writing. And really, that is a laugh. Okay. So this podcast episode is sponsored by 99designs, where you can get a free power pack upgrade, which means your design competition gets more features at 99designs.com/Joanna. Now, I wanted to tell you about the competition I've been doing on 99 Designs, because they do obviously logos, websites, apps, business cards, all kinds of stuff, packaging and things, but they also do this unique art and illustration. So I've had a design project going for the key to the gates of hell, which will be the image that goes on the front of my book cover, which should be out before Christmas, so in early December 2014. So where I've got to now is I actually, in total, I had 109 entries, and I had to rate each of those as to whether I liked it. What's fascinating is I had something in my head, but as the designers added more and more options, what was in my head kind of changed. So it's so interesting doing this kind of creative collaboration, and particularly awesome to have so many entries, which is what happens with that power pack upgrade. So that's very cool. So I did a poll. So what you can do, I shortlisted first. I chose 5 designs as a shortlist, all quite different actually, all with very different feel, look and feel. You know, I liked them in different ways. And I did a poll, so you can set it up using 99 Designs, and it will give you a tweet and, you know, Facebook stuff, and an email link you can send out to your email list and involve your fans in your book design, which is great. And I got over 200 entries with people voting on what they liked best. And what's also cool is if people vote on the competition, 99 Designs contacts them afterwards with the result, and I got a couple of emails of people saying, oh cool, the number one that I chose was the one you picked, which is, you know, so they feel more involved in the book. Once you've chosen that shortlist, the designers get a certain amount of time to submit their final iterations, and then you make a decision. And I made a decision, and I'm really happy with my final decision, and I'll be blogging about this as well as sharing the final design. But I really wanted to stress that 99 Designs is not just for book covers. It can be for these illustrations for your book cover, or for any of your, you know, website art, or, you know, maybe if you don't like an author photo and you want an author illustration, or maps for your world building or branding or whatever. And I definitely will be using this again for book cover images. I find at this point in the kind of indie publishing process that book cover designs often end up with the same stock images, but if you get a unique design done, no one else is going to have a book cover like you. So I'm quite in love with this actually. And also remember, if you end up not liking the design, you don't pay a thing, so there's no risk. So if you want to try it, go to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A, and get that free power pack upgrade. Okay, so this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting of the podcast, which is fantastic. But my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to the people supporting on Patreon, and a shout out to new sponsors, Jennifer Eremiva. Iremiva, sorry Jennifer, and Mark Cooper. And as I mentioned last show, I only have 2 paid shows a month now, so even if you just commit to $1 a show, that's $2 maximum a month, no matter how many shows I do. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen, or of course you can buy my books. Thank you so much for your support, and I'm so thrilled that you still enjoy the podcast as we come up to big episode number 200 next time, which I'm still considering what to do with. But I may well be reflecting on the last 100 shows and what's changed in my own author life since I recorded episode 100, which was quite a number of years ago now. So I think that will be, tune in to listen to that in a few, probably be week or so's time. I'm just scrolling back to look at episode 100 was in 2011, July 2011. So there's quite a lot happened since then. So I'll be excited to talk about that next time. Okay, let's get on with the interview with Sean Platt. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepenn.com and today I'm here with Sean Platt. Hi Sean.
Hi Joanna, it's so awesome to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you back on the show. Now, in case anyone doesn't listen to the self-publishing podcast, Sean, and I've agonized over the introduction, so see how I go. So Sean is a storyteller, creating myriads of best-selling fiction through his story studio, Sterling and Stone, which could be a bit of a tongue twister, with co-writers David Wright and Johnny B. Truant, as well as one of the hosts of the Fantastic Self-Publishing podcast. Is that all right for an intro, Sean?
That sounds fantastic. I'm blushing.
Yeah, well, what's interesting, you were on this show last in November 2011.
Yeah, the world has changed since then, for sure.
I know.
There was no podcast. We had one book to our name. We hadn't yet started trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Well, that's what I wanted to first ask you about. So your bio, when I introduced you in November 2011, it was for the launch of Yesterday's Gone. you were replicating the launch of a nonfiction book in the fiction space, which we both know kind of failed. And we know that
yeah,
doesn't work anymore.
That doesn't work.
It just doesn't work. So can you just talk briefly about how you've shifted from where you were then to this story studio?
Yeah, actually, even back then, this is kind of where I wanted to be. It's just, I think our word for this year is iterative, right? Like we're trying to just, you can't get the moon the first time, right? You got to send a rocket up there before you send people up there. And then I think that that's a really big lesson for us, because all three of us, you know, to varying degrees, have big plans. Like there's really cool big stuff that we want to do, and we just can't do it because we want to. We have to do the little baby steps that get us there, and you know, munchable chunks. And so I love the idea of a story studio. Like I love the idea of being all over the place with different genres and different audiences too. Like I love telling stories to my children, and I love telling very grown-up stories too. And I want to just tell stories. They make me get to know myself better, and I feel like I make a difference in the world, and I touch people's lives, and that's what I want to do. Like it feeds me. But you know, you have to start with just the one little serial story, Yesterday's Gone, right? And I think that I was really lucky to hit fiction when I did, because I had a pretty strong copywriting background, I had a pretty strong marketing background, and I think that it enabled me to see kind of the intersections that I needed to veer onto to make that first wave. And that was all like 1.0 stuff, you know. I still was doing full-time copywriting. I had a little bit, you know, to build before I could put that behind me, but that was always a goal. I never wanted to be a full-time copywriter. In fact, not being a copywriter is like the most expensive decision I've ever made. But I still really believe in it, and I believe that that's where I'm going, and I believe in, you know, the 10-year plan. But by no means did I think, okay, I'm going to do fiction and, you know, I'm going to be rich, like, because that's not how it works. It's very, very hard work, and it's constant. You know, and write, publish, repeat. That's kind of our model, right? You can't just go out there and pin your hopes on this one big book and see the book as the finish line and, oh, I'm done. I'm a published author. Well, great. You're going to, you know, languish and not do well. You really have to get out there and connect with audience one book after another. So Yesterday's Gone was just it was a way to us connect with audience in a really novel way at the time. I think, you know, you look at Amazon now and there's a lot of that language with episodes and seasons and that kind of stuff. But when we did that, not only did it not exist, but everyone said we were stupid. Like that's not going to work. And then it was just a matter of, you know, growing from there. We started the podcast really just because Johnny nagged us into it. I don't think that ever would have happened. Dave and I had talked about it, but that means nothing. You know, I think Johnny really was instrumental in getting the self-publishing podcast going. And what I really love, and I didn't know this until we were actually building the Sterling and Stone site and moving those old podcasts over, but in the very first episode, we talk about Sterling and Stone. And that's really interesting to me because I thought that was something that was just in my head that I kept to myself. I didn't really know that I had talked out loud about that so early, and that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And most of the stuff I do now is stuff that I wanted to do 6 years ago, and I just couldn't do it yet. I failed. I failed so many times online, but I keep circling back to the ideas. Okay, I'm stronger now. I can try that idea again. Like the book that Johnny and I are just finishing right now, it's called Axis of Aaron. And it's very literary. It's a standalone novel. It's not genre fiction. It has no tie into any funnel. And we wrote it because that's creatively what we wanted to do. And we couldn't have afforded to do that last year. We had to build our basic foundation before we could do that. So it's, you know, it's our version of buying a sports car. Like, it's just, I can afford to write a book that no one's gonna, like, if they read it, awesome. But it really is just a creatively rewarding experience for me. Goodness, people. So it would be really great to be able to do more and more of that stuff. And that's the last few years has just been really layering one thing on another. And I'm very careful to only take baby steps. I'm very careful to only, because there's so much I want to do, and I think it's a mistake to rush your steps, and that's why I haven't sold anything to film and TV, for example, because I think that I'm not ready for it. Yes, I have the content, and yes, I think it would do well in that environment, but I'm not ready. I want to own my copyright. I want to make my own stuff. I want to have more control, and you know, my actual traditional publishing experience has been the one that's been so out of my control and so not a part of my plans that it's maybe even more gun shy to do things that I'm not ready to do.
Mm. You know what's going to be funny? You and Johnny could win like a literary prize or something for Axis of Aaron. That would just be hilarious.
It would be hilarious. It's and do you know the story of Axis?
What you've shared on the podcast.
It's so funny because it's exactly the kind of thing where, you know, people, we would get a lot of emails from people trying to save us from ourselves. What are you doing? You can't write a story that way. But, you know, I love it. I love doing stuff that hasn't been done before. That's one of the things that feeds me too. It really drives me. If I know something hasn't been done before and I can articulate a way to make it happen, even if I don't have all those steps yet, but I know, okay, we're here and I can see this and I can see the alchemy, then it's just a matter of getting my hands into the clay and figuring out how to shape it.
Mm. And then it's interesting because we've talked before and you've said you don't really care about rankings. You know, you do these projects, you don't necessarily want to get short-term sales. You know, you've got this long-term view. How do you see, you know, how do you see the next 5 to 10 years in the business? I mean, we get so obsessed with, oh, Kindle Unlimited, the latest thing or whatever. You
yeah.
know? How do we take a longer-term view on like the 5 to 10 year? What is publishing going to look like? What are you thinking is going to happen?
Well, it's really, really hard. I think that's a mindset thing. Mm. And it's very, very difficult. So like right now, Unlimited, like there's a lot of people doing very well with Unlimited. And it's and for me, I mean, for all of us, I think we're very united on this. We kind of hate Unlimited. We kind of not Unlimited. Like, I think it's a good idea and it serves customers well. And I think that's all great. What I hate is the fact that Amazon has these amazing tools and you only get them if you're exclusive. And I really don't like the exclusivity. I really, really don't like it. In fact, we're moving not only away from exclusivity with Amazon, but exclusivity with e-tailers. Like, I want relationships with my readers. I don't want Amazon to have that relationship. Now, they deserve it. They built the platform, and I don't begrudge them. I'm not, oh, Amazon's evil. I don't think that at all. Amazon changed my life, and I'm very appreciative to Amazon. But on the other hand, I don't want to be exclusive to Amazon. The only one I'm exclusive to is my wife. Like, that's it. Like, I you know, and my partners and the people in my life. But as far as business, like, I think that I should be able to serve any reader who wants to, however they want to consume it, I should be able to let them consume it that way. And it's not cool to have a bunch of readers on Kobo that have, you know, come to read us and they're come to expect us and they're waiting for Yesterday's Gone season 5. And we're actually going to be in select for 90 days on season 5. And I hate that. I hate that I'm weak enough to do that, because the right thing to do is to just say, no, Amazon, like, you know, I'm going to offer this on my site and I'm going to offer it at Kobo and Sony and Apple and blah, blah, blah. But, you know,
so is that part of what you see, like a disruption in the space, as in Amazon won't have the dominant position in 10 years because everybody really will have changed their business model and won't allow this, basically?
Yeah, I do think that. I think a couple of big things will happen. I think somebody's going to figure out discoverability for fiction, because nonfiction, that's taken care of. Like, nonfiction it's not hard to find a nonfiction book because people are looking for answers, you know, how to market a book. Like, that is the most elegantly named title on Amazon because that is the exact phrase that people who want the content in your book are looking for. It's that simple. And so nonfiction just isn't a problem there. And not just the titles of the books, but the descriptions. They're just so in alignment with, you know, reader desire. I have this problem. I'm trying to solve it. The dream engine, like, how am I supposed to sell that on keywords or on anything like that? No one is looking for that. Entertainment is different. But I think that somebody, because it's a multi-billion dollar idea, right? Somebody is going to figure out the way to make fiction easily discoverable and shareable. And, you know, it's not Goodreads. That's not what I mean. Because
an old model.
Yeah, and you need casual readers too. Like, Goodreads isn't for casual readers. It's for people who are you know, they're readers. They would identify themselves as readers. But you need something that's just a little more commonplace, you know, where people who like to read but wouldn't identify themselves as readers. Like, that's the mechanism that we need, and we'll get there. We're just not there now. But I think that once that problem is solved, that's going to change it for people like me, for sure, you know, because we have a lot of fiction and, you know, our funnels at this point are very deep. You know, if somebody finds us, you know, on a random book and we do an intelligent job of leading them here and there and here, you know, that's a very, our lifetime reader value, I think at this point, is pretty high for an indie author, and will be exponentially so 5 years from now. Especially because we'll be able to say, okay, you just got Yesterday's Gone season 1, right? And that'll be free because we've got 6 seasons, you know, a few years from now. Now you can get the app, you can get the audiobook, you can get the full bundle, which I can't sell on Amazon because, you know,
expensive.
If it's $10.01, all of a sudden I'm down to like no commission. But on my site, I could sell that all 6 seasons for $19.99. I win, the reader wins, everybody wins. I could send them to the graphic novel, and I could probably send them to the TV show we're producing, right? And so there's we're not just trying to go wide. We're trying to go vertically and horizontally. And, you know, it'll take years and years to do that. But things like the discoverability engine, when that is, you know, really figured out, that'll be a game changer across the board. And then because right now the best discoverability engine is Amazon.
Yeah.
And the discoverability engine that Amazon uses is only fantastic compared to nothing else.
Yeah.
Right. It's not what we want. It's not what we need, but it's still by far exponentially the best that there is. And so therefore they hold all the cards. And they deserve to hold all the cards because they've still done it better than anybody else. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be that way forever. And, you know, when it doesn't, I think that will fundamentally change the game from the bottom up.
I like that you're saying, you know, it needs to be more casual readers, because I saw an advert in the Underground recently. I think it was Xbox. Must have been a terrible advert. But it said their tagline was, "This is for the players." And it was like, I was like, I'm not even a gamer, and I was really attracted to this advert, and it looked amazing, you know, the how these games look, especially for an action adventure thriller author. I'm like, wow, that looks amazing. I want to.
You
do
should
that.
Play the Tomb Raider game. I bet you'd really dig
it. I probably would. Well, I'm scared to get into gaming. I think, oh dear. I see my husband; he loves it. But this is the thing. It's like, you know, I'm not sure where apps are going to go, but I feel, and I mentioned this when I interviewed Tucker about, you know, the Oculus Rift, and you know how we can get our stories into different worlds. Now, you mentioned film and TV. Have you guys thought about the gaming side, which of course is a massive billion-dollar industry?
Oh yeah, totally. There is no media that I don't think we'll touch 10 years from now. But it has to be, you know, specific. So for example, we have a line called LOL, which are just, they're just funny books. Like their only reason they exist is for readers to laugh out loud when they read them. That's it. So that doesn't really work as an audiobook, for example. Mm. Like it's not, maybe it could, but probably not. Yeah, it's just like the jokes catch you by surprise and you laugh to yourself. But with a narrator, it wouldn't be the same rhythm and it probably wouldn't work. Yesterday's Gone could work really well as a video game. Like it just could. The environment is there for it. It works really well in audiobook. It would work really well as a graphic novel. Like you just have to take what your you can't just say, okay, I want everything to be in every place. Mm. But I think that one of the reasons that we want to go so wide is not only that are we very interested in telling all kinds of stories to all kinds of markets, but you know, that allows us to try different kinds of mediums too. You know, merchandising. We have a children's line, Guy Incognito, and very much merchandising would fit with that, but it wouldn't necessarily fit with, you know, Collective Inkwell. Maybe a few things, like I could see Borisio having like a What Would Borisio Do t-shirt or something like that, because people really like that character. But, you know, most of the stuff that's written for Guy, if it took off, could have merchandise. So I think that, again, there's nothing we wouldn't be afraid to try. But yeah, games would be great. We have, Johnny and I have a book called Namaste, which would make a fantastic just beat 'em up. It's about a Buddhist monk who goes on revenge. Yeah, revenge, a rampage of revenge. But it would make a really cool, the way it's written is very like big boss, big boss, big boss, big boss, you know? And that's the rhythm of a video game. And so, no, I love the idea of seeing our stories in because as technology has improved in that, you know, environment, the stories are getting better and better and better. Mm. And so like I like the idea of being a part of that revolution. And as games get more and more sophisticated and they're actually looking for, you know, quality writers, so because it's always been that the story has to serve the game instead of the game having to serve the story. And I think we're at a pivot point right now, and pretty soon we're going to see games that really are there to serve the story.
Mm. And yeah, I'm going to do a 3D printed thing with my next book. Going to do like collaborate with a 3D print designer and do like a pattern. And I know obviously no one's got a 3D printer yet, but it's like I'm so enthusiastic about it because it's so cool.
I love about you too. Like you're just always you're thinking in ways that it's not that other authors aren't willing to. It's just that they don't even know to, you know, And I love that. Your eyes are so wide open, and fantastic.
I'm like you. I love playing in this kind of bleeding edge, though. I mean, mm-hmm. I mentioned to you the translation thing before, and I'll talk about that separately another time. But I would not suggest people do what I do.
Well, right, and that's hard. That's hard when you're doing so many things that other people wouldn't do. It's hard. Like you started at the beginning of this conversation about not caring about sales. That's terrible advice. Like, it's the worst. I would never tell somebody to ignore their sales, you know, but it was very important last year. 2013 was a production year for us. Mm. It did not matter how many books we sold. It mattered how many franchises we built on the bottom so that we could start building on top of those. And if we start worrying about, because look, I'm good at sales. Like, I know how to build funnels. I know how to create fantastic autoresponders. I know how to get people to buy. That's not what I want to do right now. I'm not worried. Well, like, you know, growth hacking is something that I'm fascinated by because you really get your users to grow for you, right? And I love that. But what I see the mistakes people make in the growth hacking space is that, how do we grow? How do we grow? How do we grow? Dude, build an awesome product first. Like, build something that is easy to grow because it's awesome. And you know what? We can't do that in a month or 6 months or a year. That's going to take 3 or 4 years to grow something really amazing. And then we turn the growth hacking engine on. So I'm embarrassed because I don't have a single autoresponder across any of our lines. And I used to be paid quite a lot of money to make great autoresponders. I'm good at that. But it's just, I don't want to take the time to stop and do that, because then I'm putting sales before quality. And I don't ever want to do that. It should always be reader first. It should always be product first. How can we make the things that we're making more amazing? Not how can we drive more sales? I need enough to eat. I need enough to feed my children. And I need enough to take my wife to a nice dinner every once in a while. That's it. Like, everything else will come later. And I need enough to get Johnny down to Austin right now too, actually.
Yeah, and I need to make enough so I can come to one of your summits. That's like one of my plans.
It would be so awesome. I don't think I've ever had more fun than that weekend.
I was listening going, oh, damn it. You know, it's totally good. I see this happening too, though. I do feel like it's starting to mature. The space is starting to mature. I mean, the way you talk as well, you're talking in a similar way as I do, you know, as a businessman, as a CEO of your story studio now. And a lot of people ask me, and I want to ask you, how do you switch your head from Sean the introverted storytelling guy, you know, who just wants to make stuff up, to Sean, the CEO of the global publishing empire?
That's a fantastic question. I was at a friend of mine's house like a few years ago, and she's a little crazy and she's just all over the place. And I love her dearly. I'm godfather to her children. But she's crazy. She's thoroughly crazy, because she makes me look mute. She has more ideas than anyone I've ever met. And she's just all over the place. And I was doing a lot of copywriting for her. And because she was all over the place, I had to be all over the place too. And so it just made me, like, I wanted to step back. And there was I was over at her house for dinner, and she was just like, like, with all this information and all these things she wanted to do. And I just said, man, I just want to build stuff and talk about it. And that was like, it was such, I will never forget that moment, because that defined my business model in the fewest words ever. And to this day, like, that's how I define what I do for a living. I build stuff and I talk about it. And those are two different things, and they have to go in that order. You have to build your thing, whatever it is, and then you go out there and talk about it. And they're different skills, for sure. You know, when I'm building something in the morning, I get up very early every morning, and I start on what I call beats, right? Which is the basic pre-production stuff that I'm going to then hand off to Dave or Johnny, and I'm creating the world, you know? And that's purely just creation mode. And I determined earlier in this year that, because I'm not writing right now, and that kind of breaks my heart a little bit, because I do love writing, and I've had to, like, I'm building the Sterling and Stone site out. I'm doing a lot of that kind of stuff, a lot of project planning, and I keep telling myself so that I feel okay. I keep telling myself that is my writing. You know, it's still creating, like, it's a creative block, and I'm writing something that's larger than just words on a page. And I decided that no matter what, I could sacrifice words on a page, but I couldn't sacrifice that world building. I had to make that a part of each day, no matter what, because that's the building stuff. And the talking about it just happens. It's like, whether I want it to or not, it happens. You know, we have a lot of podcasts. I do stuff like this. I'm in email a lot, because we get a lot of emails that I respond to, and that takes a lot of time, and that's part of the talking about it. And then building the team is talking about it. You know, that's very much, and meetings are almost like a daily thing now because we have so many things going on. And whether I'm talking to Jacob, who is our admin / project manager, or Johnny or Dave, like there's a lot of moving parts and we're always kind of talking about it. But also the talking about it is really, really valuable too, because, and I think that's the intersection there, is that I also think that the talking about it, if you go into it with the right mindset, it's part of the building too, because I think that if you are with creative, collaborative people and you're talking things out, you're also creating stuff and you're getting smarter and you're figuring out those solutions and you're seeing those intersections. And it's shocking how often I think, what, okay, this is the way we're going to do this thing. And 10 minutes into our conversation, 10 minutes into our meeting, no, of course, that's so dumb to do it that way, because this way is clearly better. And I think that that means that you have to be, you can't bring ego into relationships like this. When you're collaborating with people, you have to be candid and you have to be willing to accept candor. And if you can do those two things and not bring your big ego into it, then, you know, I think that you can make magic easier. And I think that it's a mistake to say that you shouldn't have ego, because I think ego is very valuable. I think ego is a great thing. I want to build a really big story studio. I want to buy land in Austin and build a big place where we make stuff. And I think you have to have ego to have those thoughts. You know, when we did our summit earlier this year and we did our Kickstarter, like, we got a lot of pushback from some fans, and they said, the ego on these people. And I'm like, damn right. You know, like, of course I want to do big things and I need ego for that. But you can't bring your ego into a place where it hurts people. And you can't be, you can't bring your ego into where it's a pillow on the face of other good ideas because you think that you're right. And I never think that I'm right. I trust my gut. I trust my instincts, but I also trust my partners. I trust my collaborators, and I trust them to tell me when I'm wrong or to tell me when I'm too enthusiastic about an idea, which I am very capable of being. And so, you know, it's very nice. And I think that I'm also lucky to have such quality collaborators, you know, all the way from my first, which was Dave, who is like, he's as pessimistic as they come. And so, you know, that's actually good to temper me. But I'm also really lucky to have Johnny, who agrees with maybe 95% of what I say. But that 5% is gold. Like, it's gold, that disagreement, because it usually means that we pivot in the right way. And even Jacob, who's the newest member of the team, he's always got his hand up. You know, wait, what if we do it this way? And that's wonderful. So I think that to be the CEO of whatever, even if you're a CEO of one, you know, it really means listening to the people around you. You know, what you do with this show is genius, because you're able to bring people on and you're able to have conversations with them. And I can't imagine each one doesn't make you a little bit smarter.
Oh yeah. And that's why I do this.
Right. And it's because, but you're never thinking I'm right, I know everything. You're surrendering yourself and saying, what can I learn from the people that I'm bringing on to have a conversation with? Because they know about X more than I do. And I think that if you want to be a really good leader and you want to build stuff and talk about it and actually get momentum from the stuff that you build and talk about, you have to be a good listener. I think that's really, really, really important. You can't think my ideas are the best, because they're probably not.
No, and you, well, your relationship with Dave and with Johnny has really been making me think about this collaboration thing. And, you know, I would say I'm a, you know, like many indies, I have control freakery issues. But, you know, the way what you guys can do with more than one person is so impressive. And in working with narrators and audiobooks and translators, I'm feeling the control freakery dissipate a little bit. So you really inspire me on that. But what I wanted to ask on the collaboration is, you know, it sounds like from everything that you guys have said publicly, and you've had a long business, you know, businesses before all of this, have you had collaborations that haven't worked? Like, how do you know to trust your gut with people? And can you give people any tips on how do you know when you've got a collaboration partner you can work with?
Oh, that's such a hard question, but a great question. And it's also an interesting question. And I was actually just right before this call, I was paying attention to a thread in a mastermind group that I in, and they're talking about hiring and firing and trusting your gut. And it's hard. I had to fire my first person at 17, and it ruined me a little bit because I'm a peacekeeper by nature. Like I just want everyone to be happy. And so because that was such a horrible experience, I put off, firing people for a long, long time. And a lot of times I didn't listen to my instinct. I didn't listen to my gut, and I was wrong 100% of the time. And I think sometimes, you know, Tony Robbins says, and this is a little harsh, but Tony Robbins said, how do you know when to fire somebody? The first time you think about it. And, you know, that is a little harsh, and I don't think I would go to that extreme. But I understand where he's coming from, because all the time I've never thought about firing somebody and been wrong about it ever, not once. And I think that the difference is you don't want to get to that thought. You don't want to get to think, man, I should fire them, because you probably should if you're thinking that. But there's a lot of stuff up into that. Now, Dave and I have had a tremendous amount of conflict in 6 years where stuff that because he just doesn't believe. And I think that to really do amazing things, you have to believe that you can do them. Otherwise, you're just starting out with a brick wall in front of you. And, you know, like, I'm lucky to have somebody as creatively minded as him, but he's also very lucky to have somebody who will climb to the top of the wall and hold their hand down and, like, drag him up. And he would be the first to admit that. But I've never once, despite the conflict, ever question my relationship with Dave. I've never thought, man, I can't do this. I can't work with him anymore. Never. And that's the key. It's because I trust his intent, because it's not that he wants us to fail. It's that he's afraid. You know, he's afraid of what will happen if we fall on our face. And I'm not afraid of making mistakes, like, at all. I know I'm going to make them, and I don't see them as the enemy. Like, I see them as something very necessary to make me smarter, faster, and better at what I do. And Dave sees them as the enemy, right? He sees them as that's something that's going to embarrass me or hold me back or prove that I was wrong. And we were having a conversation yesterday, and he said, I don't want to be right. I hate it when I'm right. And I think that it's the key that you need to find people who you trust, not necessarily their opinions and not necessarily their perspective, but you trust their intent, and you trust their ability to work hard, and you trust them on that level. You know, between me and Johnny and Dave, like, we're in this business together. We don't even have contracts. Like, we don't. We're handshake guys, and we all trust each other. And I think that that's one of those things that to me, that they trust me in that way and that I trust them in that way. That's a beautiful thing. And it's very hard to transfer that. Because, again, it's like not paying attention to your sales. It's terrible advice.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't do that, everyone.
Right. I would never, ever, ever suggest that somebody shake someone's hand and trust them with their 10-year goals. Like, it's a terrible idea. But I also believe, and we've talked about this on the show too, that I believe if somebody screws me over, that it's their loss more than mine. You know, I feel like I'm a very capable person, and, you know, if you've screwed me over, then all you've done is eliminated the chance that we'll ever work together and make money. Like, so I feel like anybody who actually has worked with me, I don't think they would do that, because I think there's magic when I work with people. I do. And I don't think that people want to jeopardize that. I think that it's sacred. You know, you want to make cool stuff and talk about it. That's fun, and it's addictive. And I don't think that you would want to put that in jeopardy. But I think that that's a very hard thing. You can't teach that, right? And you can't looking for good collaborators, you have to really, really trust the person. And I think that does come with your gut. I don't think you can sit there and make a list of pros and cons, because if you're making that list, you probably don't trust them enough. Mm. You know, and I think that, because if I were to make a list of pros and cons for Dave, you know, like, I love you, Dave, you're probably listening to this, but, you know, it'd probably be pretty con heavy. But that doesn't matter to me, because the stuff that is pro is, it speaks to my soul. And I know that I can make art with this person. And I know that ultimately when it comes down to it, is Dave trusts me. And if I were to ever dig my heels in about something, no, I firmly believe this, we have to do it this way, he would trust me. He would acquiesce. And so I think that you want, it's a duality there. You need to thoroughly trust the person that you're working with, but they also have to thoroughly trust you. And if you feel even a flicker of doubt in how much you trust them or how much they trust you, then collaboration at that point can be very dangerous.
Hmm. No, that's great. Now, final question. You're an inspiring guy, and, you know, people come to you for inspiration. And I wondered, because I, you know, I get this as well. We have to feed ourselves as well as helping other people. So where do you get your inspiration and that kind of feeding? You mentioned a mastermind group. You know, how do you go into a room as the least inspirational person? You know what I mean? When you need to go somewhere and get inspired. What is that for you?
Oh, that's it. I love your questions. You have great questions. I think that masterminds are important. I do not ever want to be the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah.
Like, I don't feel, because there are people who do, like, they feel power by feeling that they're somehow better. I don't. I want to feed off of other people. I get a tremendous amount from my family. You know, and they're, my family is super, super supportive. And they want to know about the business. You know, I get to talk about the business and include them in the business. And that's really, really cool. So naturally, I get a lot of it from them. Naturally, I get a lot of it from my partners, you know, and that helps to feed me too. I haven't done as good a job in the last few years of feeding myself. I've been so, I fed myself a lot all through my life. You know, I go to at least one, if not two movies each week. Like, if it came out in the theaters and it was worth watching, I saw it. That ended when my daughter was born. Just, it gets really, really, really hard. And the first year she was born, I was just so driven to not lose some of that stuff. And I knew I couldn't manage the movies without, like, leaving Cindy home with our newborn, like, on a Friday night, which I just wasn't willing to do, even though, to her credit, she encouraged me to. And I'm like, I just don't want to do that. But I was really driven that year to read as much as I possibly could, because I could do that. And that was the last year I really read a lot. And I read, like, a couple books a week at that time. And then I had my son and things got even harder. And then I opened a preschool, and then I went online and got stupid, because when I went online, I really did. I mean, I did get stupid. I forgot every business lesson that I ever knew and thought, ooh, the internet's magic. And I thought that somehow things were different online. And so that was a struggle those first couple of years. And then I, you know, I figured it out, and then I got really, really busy with work. And then I got busy building the fiction thing, and I've just been busy, 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 busy. So I haven't done the things to feed myself, which are mostly like reading and watching movies and really good scripted television. Like, those feed me tremendously. And only now, like this last couple of months, I'm finally taking a big, deep breath, and I'm building. I'm not sitting at the computer for 12 hours a day, which I'm very guilty of doing. I'm building breaks in. We moved to this really hilly section of Austin, and I love it. Three times a day, I leave and I go on a long walk around the circuit, and it's a very hard, strenuous walk. I go down a steep hill and then up a steep hill. And when I come home, I'm like, but I do it a few times a day, and I listen to audiobooks constantly. right now I'm listening to one that you recommended, Quiet, which is fantastic. And I'm making time to watch things at night. I'm going to bed earlier and watching movies at nighttime. And so I'm feeding myself in the ways that I used to feed myself and I kind of neglected for a long time.
Mm. I'm really glad you're doing that, because when, you know, having listened to you guys for so long, I do feel that you guys have hurt yourself quite a lot in the amount of work you've done.
Yeah.
You've done really well, but, you know, you could kind of sense at times you guys were really tired.
And yeah.
You know,
well,
you
it's nice to pull back. And like this next few months is going to be really, really hard. We have a lot of things that we're trying to just kind of finish up for the rest of the year, because we've got big plans for next year, of course. but I think that next year, already when we're looking at the schedule, I have more flex than I've had in a long time, and it's good. Like I'm not dumb enough to not know that I don't need it or think that I'm superhuman. It's just that, you know, I believe that I can pour as much of myself into it for this time while we have to build, because, you know, I look at any huge startup that I really admire and they were putting in 80-hour weeks. Like, that's just what it takes in the beginning. I don't really consider any of my mistakes failures at all, but I would consider it a failure if 3 years from now I'm still working with the hours that I'm working now. Now, I like work. Like, I have no problem working. I like it. It feeds me. And so I still want to be working a lot, but I do want to have a date day every week with my wife. Like, that would be really awesome. I do want to see more movies in the theater. I do want to read more books. I want to exercise. I want to get a personal trainer so that Johnny doesn't have the best abs on the show. Like, these are things I want to do. And so, but I just have to make that as much of a priority as building the business. But right now, honestly, it's not as much of a priority as building the business. I feel like I owe it to my partners and to my family, who have been very, very tolerant with my very, you know, high risk tolerance. Like, I want to make everything okay for them before I take more time for myself.
No, fantastic. Right, so where can people find you and all of your hundreds of books online?
The best place right now is sterlingandstone.net. The site is getting a little bit neater and cleaner and easier to navigate by the day. But you can find all of us there. If you need to get a hold of me, you can do it through the contact form there. That's the easiest place.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Sean.
My absolute pleasure. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time. Thank you.